listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, friends. Ed McGrogan here once again with Steve Tigner for the Tennis.com podcast. I'd be remiss if we didn't at least acknowledge the Masters. It's played a big part in this podcast's short life this year. Even the dulcet tones of Jim Nance not going to put a warm feeling into Jordan Spieth after a massive collapse from five shots up on the back nine, losing it in pretty incredible fashion to Danny Willett, really unknown for the most part before this week. Golf and tennis, they always seem to inevitably at some point get talked about in the same light from especially outside fans of outside, I think, observers of both sports. You know, that's one thing that tennis doesn't have is that you can't it when you even a collapse in a tennis match, you kind of go, it's a gradual decline. I mean, you can still sense when it's happening, but it's you always kind of have a chance to rectify something before it turns pretty brutal, like what happened, you know, at Augusta National. It's just the games are scored differently. Not to say that there haven't been epic tennis collapses before, but I did get thinking about that as I was preparing for this.
The tradition, like unlike any other, is the collapse on Sunday at the Masters, right? Greg Norman never really recovered. You think Spieth will at some point, but you're right. Like he was leading the tournament, and people were talking about turning it off because he was about to win, and then he was out of the tournament completely.
Yeah, I think talked to people who did turn it off. In fact,
I think I feel like that the shot that he put in the water, the second shot that he put in the water, was just a weird distance that they normally don't hit from on that hole. Like he looked like he didn't know exactly how to hit that shot because even the next one that he put over and went into the bunker, it even looked like he didn't know how to hit that one. Like he was hitting it from a weird spot on the course.
Right. These pros are, and those players of that level are just, you're not practicing from the drop zone because you hardly ever are put in that situation. Yeah. And I don't know. I have to say golf always, the tennis versus golf thing, I know some people have that. I think you can enjoy both very well. I say, golf really does drama pretty well. I've got to say, when it comes down to it, it would be as if a tennis match was determined by how many points you won, rather than it being segmented into games and sets. That I think is part of the drama of golf is that there is not one shot that doesn't matter in the literally your entire score is based on every shot you take.
Yeah, each has their difficulties. Tennis, you have to beat another person. Golf, you have to be essentially perfect or you're going to lose. I guess the thing for golf does drama well, but somehow I guess it's like maybe it's like other people with tennis. I only really watch the majors. The majors are great for drama. Always watch on Sundays, but never watch any other golf. I'm not interested in anything else out there, or the race for wherever, or who's in, or the rankings, any of that. Maybe most people think of tennis that way, but that's how I watch golf.
I think that's probably the case. I mean, I could very easily see that argument posed for tennis as well, for sure. We're making our way now toward one of those majors, the French Open. We have a ways to go before that. But we were getting started on both tours on different colors of clay over starting last week and moving into this week. I wanted to just start with what happened last week in Charleston, a tournament that I was at for the last couple days, and Sloane Stephens, who was the champion there, a worthy champion, I thought, after watching her. Now, she did get the benefit of playing Angelique Kerber at not full strength for the German, who looked great actually in her quarterfinal match, but you could kind of tell over time something was not right with her. I still thought Sloane looked very well in that match, and she, you know, handled kind of a difficult final against Elena Vesnina, you know, where she was the favorite, which is always a tough spot, I think, where she handled a pretty, you know, sort of a big lost lead of her own in the first set, kind of, you know, rectified it in the tiebreaker after saving a set point and went on to kind of run away with the final. And, you know, the bigger questions I had about Sloane after the match were really kind of, where do we assess, you know, has this year really given us anything more about her that we did or didn't know? Because if you look at her play, she's played 6 tournaments, she's won 3 of them, and she's lost in the first round of all the others. And the ones that she lost first round were the Aussie, Indian Wells, and Miami. So, you know, what did this week sort of say, or this year, this thus far, say anything about you to Sloane?
Yeah, you know, I think she still has a problem with losing leads, like you said, with nerve. She was well ahead of Kasatkina in the quarters, and almost lost that. Had to then save a match point. She was up. She won the first set 6-1. Really should have won the second set. Then had to go all the way and save a match point in the third set and win the last 11 points to win the match. And there was something similar about the Vesnina match. She was ahead, then she got behind, lost a lead, and then won again. I feel like in this tournament, maybe this year, she hasn't lost that sort of, you know, that nervousness or has had the same sort of trouble closing. But I think she's finding that she can rely on her skills, her shot making when she needs it more than she has in the past. You know, she saved herself with her better play. She showed at the end of those, you know, in the important moments against Kasatkina and Vesnina that she had more game than they did. You know, maybe that, in a sense, is she's starting to learn to believe in her, and winning those matches will help her believe that, because, you know, I think it's pretty obvious and it's pretty true. When she plays well, plays relaxed, she can, you know, she has more from her serve, from her, and especially her forehand than most of her opponents. It's just a matter of, I think, getting herself to believe it. And I think these wins, they have to help. 3 titles in, but, you know, before the end of April is pretty amazing. And her record for the year, despite the first round losses, is excellent. She hasn't beaten a lot of top players. She only has 1 top 10 win, and that was over Kerber, you know, among those wins. But just winning matches, and I think winning matches that she could have lost will be big for her.
Yeah, and I think it's true about kind of getting to fundamentals with her in a way, because yeah, you can track this back to when Sloane really came on the scene, and, you know, the big announcement of that was when she beat Serena at the 2013 Aussie Open, and she went on to have a good sustained run at the majors, where she was reaching second weeks almost every time for about a year and a half. And you know, the flip side of that was she, for whatever reason, was not able to, you know, to put it together kind of on a week-to-week basis. She was taking a lot of losses in tour-level events. And, you know, I think maybe it seemed that, you know, when the pressure started to build on her as she grew into that next great American, you know, as she was saddled with that, I think really that sort of, I think, threw her for a bit of a loop. I don't think she helped her cause with, I think, the way that she treated it. If you know, remember some of the exchanges about her relationship with Serena, for example, there was a lot of, I think, noise coming in, and a lot of her success this year, she's really talked about, I think, just her coaching now, which is different. And as you say, I mean, her natural ability, you know, when you watch her play, it's clear that not many players in the world, you know, can compete with her if she's, you know, if she's just simply making her shots.
Yeah, and I think the coaching is a big deal. Kamal Murray, we've seen him on a bunch of changeover visits, and we've heard him talk to her, and you know, really have to like what he says, like the relationship, like the things that he says. You know, it's pretty hard to disagree with. You know, he tells her to be more aggressive, to to move forward, to do the things that people have been talking about with her. But she seems to respond. You know, I that relationship is good. That obviously has helped her a lot. I think, you know, one basic thing that'll help is her ranking is up to 29 now, 21 now. The higher that gets, the better her draws get at Grand Slams. And we saw in the past that when she has a good draw at a slam, she can go far, quarters of Wimbledon, at least the fourth round of all the other slams, semis at the Australian. You know, that just a basic fact of her ranking going up and keeping her from playing top players early at slams, I think that's, you know, that'll be a big help as well.
Yeah, so yeah, Sloane, I think certainly from these 3 months, someone to definitely looking forward to seeing where this goes. You know, there's two players who have 3 titles on tour, Azarenka and Sloane Stephens. So you probably, you know, wouldn't have saw that at few months ago.
No, Sloane has 3 first round losses, but she's 16-3.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's a very strange record. So let's move on to red clay and move on to the ATP this week in Monte Carlo. Masters 1000 event, not a mandatory event. You would never know that from the feel. This is after, it seems like every year someone doesn't show up for this event for one reason or another. But we're really getting the full treatment for this this welcome sort of a red carpet, if you will, to the clay court season here. And looking at, you know, kind of sensing where players could be fatigued down the road or what Roger Federer's schedule ends up being, we'll get into this in a little bit. I mean, this could actually end up being the strongest clay court term before Roland Garros. I think it's a good, it's a very good week to be watching.
Yeah, this is a good one. It's a pretty small draw. Smaller than the Masters that we just got through in Indian Wells and Miami. And it's got, you know, I'd say it's got everybody in it. Kei Nishikori's not playing, but Federer is there. Murray is there. You know, obviously Rafa and Djokovic. You really start the story, I think, of the season, which is, you know, I think is when clay, you know, that's what this clay season is good for. It goes on long enough that really – you really develop a storyline. You have the main one, of course, is Djokovic's quest for the French Open, but you also have Rafa. So, you know, where is he? What can he do on, you know, now back on his favorite surface? You have Wawrinka going back to the French Open, and you have Murray, who had a good clay court season last year. Can he turn around his year? So all of those are in play, and all those start now. And the draw is small enough that the matches get good pretty quickly.
Yeah, they really do. You know, we just saw Federer win his opener over Guillermo Garcia Lopez in straights pretty comfortably. Federer, this is his first tournament back since the Australian Open. He was scheduled to play in Miami, pulled out with sickness, and, you know, but over time, of course, has gotten over knee injury that sidelined him before. Federer, as I mentioned, his schedule originally was his only clay event, I believe, when his schedule was first released was the French Open. He's, you know, because of I think a number of reasons, he's really decided to pare down this clay season, where, you know, certainly it's his least likely chance to you know, I think to make finals, perhaps to really make inroads here. Federer looked good today. You know, I think it's pretty impressive that after 2.5 months he comes back and really doesn't even look, you know, really troubled too much. But we kind of have expected that for Federer for a while now. And even, you know, there was I think perhaps little reason to think otherwise. But you know, I think this is perhaps an interesting week for Roger, maybe in the sense that we'll kind of get a better idea of what he wants to do schedule-wise, maybe based on this event and you know, just kind of see where he's at, because we haven't talked about him for a little while.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to know what he's going to do next. I think he wanted to basically skip clay, play the French Open, and get ready for Wimbledon and the Olympics and the U.S. Open, which are the three things he's talked about, and which he's talked about for the past couple of years as his main focus. always Wimbledon, of course, but now, you know, not playing Indian Wells and Miami, I think just the competitor in him, the tennis pro in him, tennis player in him, wants to get out and play. You know, he lost some ranking points in Indian Wells where he'd been the finalist, but I think this is just a matter of he wants to play tennis again. It's been a long time. Whether or not this leads to any, you know, any serious, more serious attempt on clay or attempt for the French Open, whether he adds more to his schedule, he could obviously, but I think now for this week, it's just get out, play tennis, start to get the feel again and get ready, if not for the French, then for Wimbledon.
Yeah, and his principal rivals at all those tournaments are here as well, as I mentioned, Djokovic, Nadal. You know, we've talked about Rafa quite a bit, really, with clay. I think it's almost like, you know, I think at this point it's perhaps has been established that this the days of Rafa sweeping European clay may be behind us as quickly as it seemed to come and go. Yeah, Djokovic, to me, it's almost kind of he may be in sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario where any win you kind of just nod, move on, and look toward the French as really the, you know, the final arbiter of his clay court success. But you know, you've made good points, I think, about Djokovic wanting to really keep his foot on the gas pedal and just retain that you know clear number one by a country mile over the number two in the world. And I guess he really only does that if he wins these tournaments, which, you know, he's a heavy favorite to do so. So, you know, any thoughts on maybe those two principal characters in this in the principality?
Yeah, for Djokovic, I think in reality, it'll, you know, his French Open, how he does it, the French will be decided there. You know, last year he won everything, and then suddenly he has to play a 2-day semifinal against Murray, is a little tired for the final, and then he faces a guy who's on fire in the final, and that's it. You know, none of the preparation, none of the other tournament wins mattered at all. So in reality, that's what the French Open, that's his French Open will be decided there. But in leading up to it, I think he wants to, you know, like you said, keep that sort of air of invincibility, keep his, you know, the aura around him. That's a big part of it. That's a big part of what keeps him successful. The idea in people's heads that this guy is almost impossible to beat, and you know he can only do that by continuing to win. I was impressed with the way he competed in Indian Wells and Miami, two tournaments he doesn't need. They don't even lead up to the French Open, but he obviously wanted those. He played them as just the way he always plays anything, and won them both. And I think that's where he'll go into Monte Carlo and Rome. He especially doesn't want to lose a match to Nadal at one of these tournaments in Monte Carlo, which is obviously a possibility. He doesn't want to get that conversation started again. So, you know, there's definitely plenty for Djokovic to play for and to get ready. You know, he sort of immediately has to get ready on clay. As far as Rafa goes, yeah, sweeping the clay court season is, you know, almost certainly over. He didn't win any of the tournaments last year. He only made one final, and he was beaten badly in Madrid final by Murray. This year, it feels like for the first time, each match is going to be a question mark with him. He could play Dominic Thiem early here. That's going to be tough. He already lost to him on clay once this year. So there's almost anything other than a first round now feels like you're going to have to watch out, to see Rafa's form against anyone, which is, of course, you never had to say in the past. So in that way, it makes the clay season much more open and interesting, you know, than it used to be. But we'll see. I feel like we've been waiting for him to come around on clay or any surface for so long. I don't think we're ever going to get back to where he's just consistently day to day dominating again.
Yeah, it's. I think we'll get a good idea of that this week in particular. I think this will be very telling for Rafa based on that fact alone. I don't think we are I think we would expect Rafa to kind of give everything he has. I don't think he's kind of holding anything back for any reason. There's no real injuries that have crept up that would suggest that he's kind of playing it safe for any reason. I think Rafa wants sort of that he wants the titles and the sort, I think, sort of justification, a way of really where, you know, how he's doing now at this stage of his career. So I think we will see a bit of that one way or another this week in Monte Carlo. Djokovic, as you said, I think more and more players, especially, have been vocal and almost admitting that they are clearly witnessing a definitive number one in their midst here, and for good reason. They have said that it's, you know, even Nadal himself said that Djokovic is, until proven otherwise, you know, the favorite kind of everywhere. You know, what else? Anything? Maybe some other players beyond the main names that we've been discussing that might, maybe not even in Monte Carlo, but in the clay court season as a whole, that, you know, we should be keeping an eye on. Team, you mentioned, of course, is one. I wonder where perhaps even someone like a Nick Kyrgios who had a great term in Miami. Yeah, he's beaten Roger Federer in Madrid before. It's a long clay court season, and I think we'll have, over that time, see more and have a lot more to chew on than just the top guys at the Masters.
Yeah, I think one guy to look at right now is David Goffin. He's coming off two good tournaments in Indian Wells and Miami, really breakthrough tournaments, semifinals at a Masters, and he really challenged Djokovic there. And if anything, he's more natural player on clay. That's where he first kind of made his appearance or breakthrough at the French Open a few years ago, 4 years ago. And he won his first round in Monte Carlo. It'd be interesting to see where he goes with this little emergence and whether he can bring that over to clay. I think he can. He's up in Djokovic as part of the draw here. That could be interesting. And of course, Wawrinka. You know, you just never know. It's almost like you don't talk about Stan because you just know that it could go any. It's like it's not even worth talking about because anything could happen. All you can say is he could lose in the first round. He could win the whole thing. He could blow everybody away. We sort of know that anything is possible with Stan. So he's obviously in there. He's won Monte Carlo. This could be a big event for him. He has never done well in the U.S. and he didn't do well in the spring this time. But he's another guy, like, you just have to watch
Clay
out.
Clay tends to rejuvenate him almost. It seems like a bit too,
yeah,
as we've seen. Yeah. So yeah, there's plenty of players worth considering on the men's side this week, and that's what we'll get into on our next edition of the podcast after the Monte Carlo Masters, where I'm sensing there will be a final of some significance, as you said, a very tiny 56-player draw. The field is pretty good from the start, and I think they'll carry through until the weekend. So until next time, Ed McGrogan and Steve Tigner here on the Tennis.com podcast. Thank you for listening.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.